Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to call the meeting of Climate and Energy to order. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the meeting minutes from February 7th?
Madam Chair, I have. I move their approval.
Any discussion to the meeting minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And today we've got a couple of bills that we're going to be hearing. First up, we have Representative Pinto, Chair Pinto is joining us today. And let's see, since, what is the motion here? I'm not. Awesome. Welcome to the committee, Representative Pinto. Since Representative Pinto is not part of the committee, I am going to move House File 1021 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Pinto has an author's amendment coded DE1. And so I will go ahead and move the DE1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Pinto, welcome. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. I'm so glad to be with all of you. So this bill was brought before the committee last term, and it was included in the Jobs and Energy Conference Committee report. It's a little bit of an unusual situation. So there's a 144-acre site, a former Ford Motor Plant site in my district in the southwest part of St. Paul. That site is now being redeveloped. I think it's one of the most kind of exciting opportunities in the country in terms of just that sheer amount of space in an urban area. There's a portion of the site that the hope is to put a solar array to help provide power to that site. It's called the Highland Bridge Development is the name of the site. It's about a single megawatt. And the place where the site is, it's called Area C, is kind of the term of it. It's a 7-acre site. It's a concrete cap next to that's right on the bluffs of the Mississippi River. And the plan is to put the solar array on top of that. And the contingency, the purpose of this contingency is to ensure that if a solar array is constructed, that it wouldn't get in the way of a future corrective action determination by the MPCA. There are some materials buried at that site that should be that they stay contained and everything's fine, but if the MPCA were to decide in the future there needed to be that those materials had to be taken up, then this provides a contingency to be able to ensure that that happens. The solar array is going to aid building owners, both commercial and residential, to meet the SB 2030 design standards, and I'm working with Xcel Energy on this, maybe at this point we could bring up Jim Pearson from Xcel, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair, to provide more background and more additional context and answer member questions with me.
Great. Welcome to committee, Mr. Pearson. Please enter your name for the record. And
well, thank you, Madam Chair. And my name is Jim Pearson. I'm with Xcel Energy. And as Representative Pinto said, this is a unique opportunity to be part of a larger conversation about constructing a solar array within the city of St. Paul. Obviously, when you work with communities like St. Paul or Minneapolis that are relatively landlocked, opportunities for a large solar array are limited. So this is a unique opportunity. And so we've been involved in discussions around this concept or idea with the master developer of the Highland Bridge development, which is Ryan Companies. And we've been really working with them to try to partner in a variety of different ways. And one of them is around bringing renewable energy to the site that involves both rooftop as buildings are constructed and homes are constructed, as well as this array that is adjacent to the site, as Representative Pinto alluded to. One of the values of doing an array like this that's adjacent to the site is that does aid homeowners and business owners in complying with the sustainable building policy. Typically, that does not apply to buildings that are not commercial or multifamily, but the uniqueness of the zoning plan requires it across the footprint. And so the solar array does present some value from that perspective too. As members know, when you talk about sites that have that type of history, they present unique challenges. And I know, you know, the state did a study a couple of sessions ago around the the potential at closed landfills to do solar and things like that. So again, make a long story short, we've been working through this. Our role in this project would be to be the potential buyer of the energy. We would not be the owner of the solar array. We would be looking to enter into a power purchase agreement. One piece I would like to make real clear is even if this bill is passed, we still have a regulatory process ahead of us. Obviously, as a regulated public utility, we're not allowed to enter into a power purchase agreement until we've gone through and secured the necessary regulatory approvals. So that would all come subsequent to this bill. However, it's pretty difficult to bring something that is not, bring a contract forward where the terms haven't been finalized. And so we find ourselves sort of in this circular pattern, which is why we've worked with Representative Pinto and the others to bring this idea forward. So we're very grateful that Representative Pinto has the bill again this year. We worked on it last year, and we're hopeful that it would seek consideration again this year.
Thank you. Maybe just to add one thing. Last spring, I had some really extensive conversations with Mr. Pearson, who's been working incredibly hard on this, with folks from the city, from the neighborhood, environmental groups, Friends of Mississippi River. It's sort of been a really complicated series of conversations, which took quite a few hours. I know he was working incredibly hard on it, and then he and I were working together on it, which resulted in this bill and resulted in being advanced in the conference committee report, and again, hopeful that the members will support it now, but really eager for questions. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We do have some questions. Representative Carroll?
Thank you, Chair. So just a couple of questions regarding the history of the land. So the city of St. Paul owns it currently, right?
Representative Pinto.
Actually, I think Mr. Pearson can help remind me. It's very complicated who owns each slice.
Okay,
Representative Carroll.
Parcel.
Even that a little.
Whatever.
Mr. Pearson.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Area C site, which is what we're specifically talking to with this bill, is owned by Ford Motor Company and will stay owned by Ford Motor Company. So there is no plans to sell that property. The master developer of the site, Ryan Companies, has a air lease agreement to use the cap. It is a 7-acre concrete cap. If you look at Google's maps at this part of St. Paul, it jumps out at you. And so they have an agreement for this purpose with Ford Motor Company to use, essentially the air rights of the property. But the property is owned by Ford Motor Company.
And Chair,
Representative Carroll.
So the air rights to put a solar array on?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct.
And if I could follow up, Chair. I'm just trying to think of whose liability is it. It doesn't sound like it should be the city of St. Paul's. It sounds like it should be Ford since they own it.
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, liability for the cleanup remains with Ford. So in terms of the contract around a solar array, those are the type of agreements that we have and enter into frequently, and of course there's regulatory approval that's necessary. So those type of agreements in terms of non-performance, so for example, if the solar array did not perform, that risk is carried by the developer. So those type of things are handled in the normal contract. There's a difference between the liability associated with operating the array and the liability associated with any potential cleanup. And so depending on the issue, we have different partners who would step in.
Well, thank you, Chair. Obviously, I'm talking about the liability as to the property in relation to the array. But for the issue with the property, there wouldn't be an issue with the array. So I'm trying to get at whose ultimate responsibility is it to make any remediation if necessary? It seems to me that we're putting the horse before the cart in terms of liability and avoiding this whole arrangement to provide funding when it should be the property owners, unless I'm missing something.
Mr. Pearson.
So, Madam Chair, members, the liability for the cleanup, it's my understanding, obviously I'm not a party to all those conversations, but it's my understanding that that resides with Ford Motor Company. Now, Ford Motor Company is agnostic to a solar array. Whether we work with our partners to move forward with that idea or not, that is, you know, again, they're agnostic. So from the from Ryan Companies and the other developers at the site, the idea of having the solar array, and I think there's quite a few local members outside of Highland Bridge who are excited about the idea as well. They would like to see something happen, and so we have tried to construct an arrangement to allow the solar development to go forward and allow us a path to seek regulatory approval to do that, but not get in the way of any potential cleanup that may occur or may be required. And so that creates a new level of risk. This idea that, you know, we all partnered and put a solar array, and then 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, a cleanup decision was made, and Ford Motor Company had to step in and do that, and therefore disrupt the array. That disruption of the array, the business risk associated with that outcome, which, again, in talking to our partners, is a very low risk, but if it were to occur, it would have a high price tag. That is the risk that we're trying to manage with this bill.
I understand that.
Oh.
And Chair.
Representative.
So the question is, whose risk is it? And it sounds like you're saying it's the developers as opposed to Ford, because it has to do with the air rights, is that correct, as opposed to the land? And the remediation would occur on the land, in the land, not in the air.
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, the remediation would occur in the land, correct. And that would be, it's my understanding, again, that would be Ford Motor Company's responsibility.
Maybe. Or yeah, I'll let Representative Carroll.
Go ahead, and then I'll ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Carroll. So I think what's going on here, right, is so it's true, Ford has that liability in the land, so kind of would have an incentive to just don't do anything. We have an opportunity to have a solar array that can provide this really incredible opportunity for the community. There is concern that if the solar array is on top of there, that might be a disincentive then to do necessary cleanup. You've got, as I mentioned, there's environmental organizations, there's community organizations wanting to kind of do the right thing regarding this site all around. And so what might be the most conservative approach from any one party's perspective might not be the best overall outcome. And that's why sort of this plan has been reached as a way to say we hope that the solar array goes on, that the stuff inside there stays inside there, no remediation is necessary, it's all good, that's great. If not, though, there needs to be some opportunity to provide some reassurance at the start of the process that we're going to be able to kind of finish it and see it through. And I see Mr. Pearson nodding. So hopefully that's helpful as kind of a setup for this.
And I understand all that. The question is that where does the risk start? And it sounds like it doesn't. It starts above the land. If you're saying that a solar array essentially is not part of the land, not part of the property, it sits on top of it. Is that a correct understanding?
Representative.
I think it is correct. Yeah, the solar array sits on top of the land. Correct.
And Chair. So therefore, the liability would start there as opposed to on the ground or under the ground for remediation purposes. Does that make sense?
And Madam Chair, I don't know that it does necessarily. I mean, if the solar array is on top, it has to be removed in order for the remediation to occur. So you've got this situation where one party is responsible for the solar array, but that has to be moved in order to address the liability of the other party for the stuff that's in the ground. So that's where the complexity lies. I don't know if I'm fully engaged to try to answer your question, but yeah.
I don't think I'm communicating my question properly. So if I could, Chair.
Representative Carroll.
Again, it comes down to whose risk is it and why is it the risk? So it seems like it wouldn't be Ford's, otherwise you wouldn't be here. And I'm just trying to understand why it's not Ford's when they own the property.
Representative Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair and Representative Carroll, maybe I'm getting tripped up. There's different pieces, you know, there's different risk associated with the project. If I'm understanding your question correctly, You're asking about the risk associated with the solar array itself. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the risk associated with the solar array itself, if it were to malfunction, if it were to cause some problem, that is laid out in the terms of a power purchase agreement or the contract with the solar developer or the solar owner. And that is a private third party.
Representative Carroll.
Okay. So let's back up a little bit. So below the solar array, so you, if you have remediation, it's going to be the ground, right? It's not going to be the solar array, obviously. So I'm trying to get at whose risk is it, whose responsibility? Sounds like your Ford is going to let you put the solar array on there at your own risk. Is that correct? Is in terms of there's any remediation that has to happen? Or will they participate in the liability of remediating?
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carroll, I can't speak for Ford, obviously. If there was an environmental, if there was an environmental damage as a result of the solar array, those issues are typically handled in the contract that we would have with the owner of that solar array as, you know, the power, as the entity buying the power from the array. We would want to shield ourselves from that. So the owner of the solar array would carry that specific risk.
Representative Carroll, does that give you any clarity?
I still don't think I'm communicating my question to you in terms of the ultimate risk of loss coming from the property due to any remediation that would interfere with the solar array. And I'm certainly in support of this solar array. I don't want that to be confused. I'm just trying to see if Ford should be responsible for this as opposed to the state.
And I don't think it would interfere with the solar. It would, well,
if there's a need for mediation for which Ford is responsible, Mr. Pearson can correct me if I say something wrong. If there's a need for mediation for which Ford is responsible, the solar array would have to be taken off at expense, right? And so, there's a challenge there in putting the solar array on in the first place, which Ford is not responsible for, right? In order to then be able to get at the thing that it is responsible for. So that's what we're trying to do, is to kind of solve this puzzle here.
So it sounds the state would be assuming the risk that that would happen, and then therefore be responsible as opposed to Ford. I think that's what you're saying.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The state would not be taking on the responsibility of the remediation or to the liability for remediation at all. It's simply facilitating the removal of the solar array.
All right. I'll just let it go.
Next up, we have Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to get back to that kind of line of questioning a little bit. So by this fund setting aside, it wouldn't be the state taking responsibility for the remediation or the removal of these solar panels, or would it?
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, I think the light may have gone off. Finally, I apologize. The remediation, so the risk that we're talking about is not that we're essentially leaning on the renewable development account. So that's not the state. It's the renewable development account is a special revenue fund at Minnesota Management and Budget, but it's funded by dollars that go from Xcel Energy ratepayers. So this particular risk that we haven't been able to get over, which is, if the array had to be disassembled and reinstalled to allow for corrective action or removal, that risk is unique to this site. And that's why we've come forward with the bill to lean on the RDA as the contingency fund in the event that this risk became a reality.
To facilitate renewal. Representative Swazinski.
Right. So thank you, Madam Chair. So to the author of the bill, so is the RDA money state money, or is the RDA money ratepayers' money?
Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Sudinski, as a non-climate energy member, I'm probably the wrong person to answer that. I'll simply note that what we're talking about here is development of renewable energy. And so it seems to me from the outside that helping the development of renewable energy presumably is what the renewable development account is about.
Representative Sudinski.
just a question to anyone in the room, maybe Mr. Eliff, Madam Chair. Could you answer that question?
Mr. Eliff.
Madam Chair, Representative Slezinski, the RDA used to be wholly an account with Excel.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, it was made a state account. It is money from Excel ratepayers, but the money is placed in a state account, and obviously the legislature has spent it according to its wishes.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's not necessarily, it's not taxpayer money, it's a special account, special revenue. So by no means this bill means that state taxpayers are responsible for this. This is a rate only. This is ratepayers' money. That's already, we can all agree to that in this room. So it's just ratepayers' money that happens to get set aside into this account. It has nothing to do with the state. We just happen to collect it.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Sounds good.
Anything to add?
Madam Chair, the only thing I would add to that is it's $3 million that the state otherwise could spend according to its wishes.
Certainly, certainly.
But it won't be spending it because it's going to be held in reserve.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just to be clear, it does, if it's not spent, it does revert back to the RDA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just another question to the author or to Mr. Pearson from Excel. So I'm just going to lay a scenario out. So, you know, obviously solar is a depreciating asset. And today, that asset, when it's brand new, the value would be, I mean, I'm guessing the value would be considered at $3 million because you have to take it off, remove it, plus the labor and the cost materials. But let's say this remediation needs to occur in 20 years. So just as I'm working with my insurance agent and my roof gets hailed on, they ask me, well, how old is that roof? If it's 20 years, do I get the full value or of replacement? Or do I say over those 25 years, oh, technically you've gotten 20 years out of those shingles from general use, they are destroyed, you would get a percentage of value. Does this bill take into account the actual value of the solar and the cost when it comes to that? So let's say in 20 years, hey, there's a leak, MPCA comes, say, Ford, you need to clean this up, we need to move those. And so our ratepayer is going to pay for a brand new solar array when in likelihood the thing's probably at 50% or 20% capacity at that point. So is that a pretty good deal for ratepayers, or is that going to be, like, is there a depreciation, you know, like it's $3 million if it happens in 3 years, which I think we'd agree that, yeah, that would make sense. But in 20 or 25 years, should we be essentially replacing that after the remediation when it's essentially a dead product?
And I will just say, if looking at the bill, it's not replacing the solar, it's about moving it. But I will defer to Mr. Pearson and the author.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, from Xcel Energy's perspective, we're not the owner of the Ray. So we are entering into a power purchase agreement that has a term of 20 years. So if after 20 years, we have no obligation to buy the power. So the system owner would have to either, we'd have to negotiate a brand new contract and seek regulatory approval, or the owner of the array would have to find a different off-taker. So, you know, thinking about your question, you know, in year 18, if this were to occur, again, I think we would have to look at the cost benefit of, you know, removing and starting anew. So I don't have a great answer for you. I would, you know, experience would say that would be a negotiated event. But again, it, you know, looking at the language of the bill, we could follow up and talk more specifically. I could also take that question back to our power purchaser group. That's the group at Xcel Energy that negotiates the terms of power purchase agreements. And I could bring back a better answer to the committee.
Representative Swedinski, and we do have four more.
Sounds good. Thank you. I'm full of them today. If I read the bill correctly, is that the bill, or does that change it in the amendment? Because you said in the regular bill it said for any cost incurred should reinstallation, redesign it, new equipment, that's what the money could be used for. So it's not just removal. Or did that change in the amendment?
Well, I will refer to the author, but as I interpret it,
It is as described in the DE1 that was adopted by the committee. So that language in that amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would pay for removal, storage, transportation costs incurred for, and then cost a redesign of the new equipment, infrastructure, and made necessary by activity. So it would cost for the pullback and the reinstallation and redesign. Okay. Sounds good. All right. Thank you.
Next, we have Hemmingson Yeager, Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Thanks. Do you know what material is stored underneath? I'm just curious.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Representative Hemmingson Yeager. There's probably a fair amount of toxic stuff in there. That site was operated as a Ford Motor plant for close to 100 years, I think. Yeah, close to 100 years. I'll just note for the site, there's the waterfall there to generate power. There's the train tracks that lead in. It was quite this integrated, kind of a marvel of modern engineering. And unfortunately, it was also, pretty bad ways of keeping materials. So I'm not sure if Mr. Pearson knows more. I think he can maybe share a little more about what's in there.
Sure, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The MPCA has been overseeing the site cleanup for I believe since the 1990s. It's my understanding, so this is anecdote, but it's my understanding that, again, when the Twin Cities Ford assembly plant was constructed in the 20s, that's where the hydro facility comes from. Early on, they would take materials from the paint department or other and barrel them and push them over the bluff, essentially. It's my understanding, again, just anecdotally and being around this conversation for the last couple of years, that practice stopped somewhere in the late 40s. So fast forwarding to the 1970s, it's my understanding that the lock and dam was rebuilt. The construction debris from that project was loaded on top at the same spot. There was some road work that was done, other debris, and then eventually in the early 1980s, it's my understanding that the concrete cap was then installed. There is more history. We could work with our partners to get you a better timeline of known activities, but that is what I picked up from being around the conversation.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yeah, so would the installation of such an array unintentionally disrupt or disturb that material underneath, or that concrete cap is pretty good?
Madam Chair, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, I don't think that the installation of the array would disrupt that in any way. It's just that there is this ongoing testing and examination. It's been going on for quite a long time. And I think, the odds are fairly slim at this point that there would be a need for remediation. And I don't think there's any concern that solar array installation itself would disturb that. It's more just that once it's on there, the worry among some groups is that once it's on there, that provides a disincentive to do remediation if in fact it's needed. And so that's the reason for this, is to say, on the slim chance it's necessary, we can have the reassurance to feel comfortable putting the solar array on now in case that's necessary.
Yeah, thanks. Totally understandable. I just, East Metro, a little sensitive to materials underneath the ground, so just kind of was thinking. So thank you.
Next up, we have Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to that point, actually, is this bill going to the Environment Committee so that MPCA, because I don't think MPCA is in the room right now. I don't know why they would be, but they could actually maybe testify as to the site, and I know that they've had monitoring wells surrounding it, so we can know sort of the trajectory of the plume, that if there is one, and which direction it's going, how much particulates it's got in it.
I think
so. The bill is just to the bill. It's being laid over because it's appropriating RDA. I think we do have somebody from PCA in the room that could potentially.
Yeah, thanks. And I'll just note that I don't think there's any allegations that anything is coming out of the site at this point. So it's not that point. It's simply that if it were to be necessary, then PACA were to order something. So the bill didn't go to Environment last term, and I don't know that it would need to. I don't know why it would need to this time. The issue is just that if there were to be an order, then the issue is having the RDA funding available to facilitate the array being put in there now. Yeah, and then removed necessarily. Mr. Pearson, I guess this is my add.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, and members, the one thing that might be helpful is the MPCA has quite a bit of information on their website specific to this Area C. Again, they have been overseeing activities for a long time, and so much of what I've learned around Area C is from the MPCA's website, which I found very helpful. So, again, just sharing that as an information source.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's good, and I can read that, and I have a mixed municipal waste dump in my district that was built in the 70s, I believe, that has been leaching things into the groundwater for quite some time. So it's not like I'm not familiar with this. Again, just not the jurisdiction of this committee. Did you say, Madam Chair, that they were in the room? They just wanted, I mean, it would take like a 10-second thing to just explain they're here. That might alleviate some of the concerns of the, especially on your side of the aisle today.
Mr. Kadelka with PCA.
And he's taught me a lot about plumes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I work on remediation issues. In terms of Area C, we're in the midst of the investigation towards the tail end of it. Ford Motor Company is the one that's proceeding with that. One of the things we're looking to investigate is how the flooding of the Mississippi River interacts with the waste. The goal and what Ford has agreed to is two sampling during two flooding events. We've had one flooding event, and right now we're waiting for the second one, and nature will provide that when it's ready. And then after that point, we'll do a feasibility study to determine what needs to be done for the cleanup, as mentioned. And that is the unknown at this point until we can get all the information in to be able to make that the determination. So as mentioned before, this is something that we do not see a present risk to individuals, but something we just want to make sure we address and clean up to prevent the potential risk in the future.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's super helpful. Did you detect anything in your first study of the first flood?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I would have to ask our staff, and I could provide that to the committee if they'd like.
That'd be helpful. Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. I wouldn't normally ask the MPCA to come down in an energy committee, but it's super helpful. And I have worked with this gentleman many times. He's been very helpful, come out to my district. I should say we have talked about an issue in my district many, many, many times. And I think over the course of 2 or 3 hours at a time, talk about plumes and monitoring wells. And I'm sure they've got monitoring wells on this site as well and must be satisfied that that wasn't an issue, and so the flooding must be the second issue. Again, not our area of expertise, but it seems to be something that's of great concern today in this committee, so I thank you for that. I do have just a couple other energy questions, if that's all right, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Kadelka. So you had said, Representative Pinto, that it's a 7-acre spot, and Mr. Pearson had talked about purchasing agreements. I'm just wondering where the bids are kind of coming in at and how large of a solar array that would hold on that 7-acre spot.
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, the approximate size of the solar array is 1 megawatt. Depending on how you lay it out, that may change a little bit. Obviously, the concrete cap is what's of value. That concrete cap, because it's there, is what enables us to even move forward with this particular site, because we have that foundation to work off. And it's a ballast type system. We're not driving pilings into the ground or anything. Okay. So depending on its layout, it is estimated to be 1 megawatt. It could be a little less, could be a little bit more. It'll depend on the layout. Now, because we haven't sought regulatory approval for this, again, the design, things like that, are still part of the discussion with the developer.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I believe you had mentioned to me earlier that it was tracking the sun. Is the solar array hopefully going to be designed to maximize the solar resource right there?
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that would be the intent, is to maximize the energy production. Because it's a ballast type system, it will be fixed, so it will not track with the panels will not track with the sun. That would require a different type of racking system, which we were not able, it wouldn't be feasible you know, a site that you don't want to penetrate the cap, obviously. So from that perspective, it would be a fixed array.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. That's super helpful. So a fixed array, not tracking this end, but a 1 megawatt capacity, nameplate capacity. And I think we had had an offline conversation. I think he had said that it's an actually pretty good site as far as the solar resource, that it's unimpeded by other shadows and has a good face and all that kind of thing. And the only other question I had is, what do we think that the purchase agreement might come in at? You may have gotten a few bids back. Do you have any idea of kind of where we'll land, how much we'll be paying for that energy? Because I'm an Xcel Energy ratepayer.
Mr. Pearson.
So, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, the pricing that, well, to back up a moment, we did go through an RFP process. We had approximately 10 solar developers look at the site. We had three actually submit proposals. One of them dropped out in the discussion or the evaluation process, so we were left with two. The low bid is the entity that we've been trying to get the terms of the PPA negotiated with. As a result of that, we found this, you know, we ran into this risk problem, which is the whole the reason for the bill. So in terms of pricing, it's very comparable to what you'll see in solar garden type projects. We have some unique challenges because of the conditions of the site, interconnection costs, property taxes, there's things like that that have materially impacted it. But to give you a reference point, that's about where this project is coming in. So it's certainly on the higher side of what we've seen. That is an argument that we're going to have to make in front of the commission in order to proceed. If the commission determines that the process is dated, or the cost of that power purchase agreement is too high for Xcel Energy customers to be involved in, then we won't be able to go forward with the PPA. So that lies ahead, and of course nothing in this bill puts the thumb on the scale in that. That is something that lies ahead. I will note, I can't say with any level of certainty, but in informal conversations, we're hopeful that some of the provisions in the IRA that was passed at the federal level would aid in the pricing. We've seen some upward pressure on panel prices, so how those lines and how that's all going to play out is to be determined. But we haven't been able to really get over the issue around, what the bill is seeking to help with, and so some of those details are still going to have to be negotiated out.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Any follow-up to that, Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think solar garden cost is $130 to $140 a megawatt, depending on the value of solar. And as PUC Commissioner Joe Sullivan had come in, some of the latest PPAs, some of the newest purchase agreements were between $50 and $70, so just so that we're fully informed. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we have Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who this question is for. It might be for the commissioner from MPCA, but this appropriation is going to be available until 5 years after the PCA issues a corrective action determination. Is the only thing left to, like when does the PCA say it's good? We're done. Is there some bound to that, or can that happen? You know, how long is the only thing you mentioned that might need is this other flood situation to be able to look at? Is that the only thing remaining? I think it's the question is for you.
I think we're getting a nod from the commissioner.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
I think yes. I think he's saying yes. Did you want more information than that, Representative Kraft?
Yes. Yeah, so the only thing left is this flood determination?
Yes. I think that was.
All right. So then, Madam Chair, if I may, so you're waiting for this flood to happen, and after that, you'll be able to issue your corrective action, and nothing else will hold you back from issuing, from meeting the terms of this legislation.
Commissioner Kudelka.
Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. Correct. The last piece of the investigation is the results from the flooding events. Ford then would present a feasibility study on various options for the cleanup based on the information there, and the agency then would make a determination of how it needs to move forward.
Yeah, Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So we're then looking at a fairly bounded period of time until the next flooding situation, I believe. My question is then, and I think this one may be for Mr. Pearson or Representative Pinto. In subdivision 5, it looks like most of these things are removal and transportation, and the other things are if something happens because of the agency's work plan. But on item 3 and item 5, it doesn't reference the agency's work plan. And so I'm wondering if it should be referencing the agency's work plan, because one thing is lost revenues resulting from the inability of the solar energy generating system. And I'm wondering, because that seems to be not referencing the agency's work plan.
Do you have thoughts on that?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, first we'd be happy to kind of work through the language as we proceed with the conversation. One of the risks that has been pointed out from the solar owner perspective is they have a contract with, hopefully, Xcel Energy. So we're counting on that energy. If they can't perform, we have to go get that energy elsewhere, which means there may be a cost associated with procuring that in the market or something. And so that is the risk that that item is kind of pointing out to. And so that, I think, is why it's added. But I'd be happy to kind of think about that more and work with you to find the appropriate language.
Madam Chair, so that's not associated with the – that's separate from the PCA issue, that item, item 3.
Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, yes. It's part of the power purchase agreement, and so that would only come into play if the corrective action determination disrupted the array and the array wasn't able to produce the energy, and then I've got this cascading sort of impact. And so that is where that is coming from. Obviously, the work plan is the beginning of that, but there is this cascade that can occur, and so that was what we were trying to address.
All right, so I think I understand, and maybe we should follow up, but I'm just, so it is as a result of something that would happen because of the corrective action. It's not just ensuring the power purchase agreement.
Madam Chair,
Representative Pinto.
I might just help. This is Representative Kraft. It's subdivision 4 is the thing that kicks in first. This only happens if the owner files a request for distribution of funds that and describes the nature of the impact of the work plan, the results in economic losses, et cetera. So subdivision 5 is then expanding, describing, but everything is tied to subdivision 4. Everything is tied to there being a corrective action by the MPCA. So, yeah, so in case you're reading this, it's thinking, this means, whatever, the money flows. Well, no, this is only if there's a corrective action regarding Area C and the solar array has to be moved. And then this describes what can happen there.
Final question, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say, if we need to move on, we can move on.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So, Representative Pinto, obviously, I'm a big fan of solar projects. I'm in support of this. My one question is, have you done any consultation with the Prairie Island Indian community?
Oh.
So it's my personal stance that I don't like to support the spending of RDA money if the Prairie Island Indian community hasn't signed off on it. They typically do. I was waiting for a text message back from Blake Johnson to see if he was on board with this, but I haven't heard anything, so just wondering.
I'll direct to Mr. Pearson if I can.
Madam Chair, Representative Hollins, no. We work with the Prairie Island Indian community on many, many issues. So I would be happy to talk to Mr. Johnson and others within the community to see if there are any concerns and bring that information back to the committee. I'm not aware of any, but we certainly could follow up on that.
And Madam Chair, I'll just note that's a great flag, Representative Hollins, and yeah, we'll make sure to do that. I will note that it of course made it through quite a lot of the process last spring, and I know there were no concerns expressed at the time, and important to do it as well. So I really appreciate you highlighting that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And Seeing no further questions, Representative Pinto, did you have any final comments?
Yeah, I just want to note this is, I really appreciate the conversation. And this is a pretty significant point for my community, I think more broadly. This is renewable energy that needs, that would be really terrific to have in place. It's an unusual situation, and a little bit of a contingency help will be able to make it happen in a way that I think it would not happen otherwise. So would appreciate the committee's consideration in your omnibus bill. Thanks.
And with that, the bill is laid over. Thank you very much, Representative Pinto and Pearson, and Commissioner Fidelka, too. Next, we have House File 826 and Representative Newton.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Representative Jerry Newton. And I am offering House File 826 to be re-referred to Labor and Industry.
Great. And I think, Representative Newton, do you have an amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. I have an amendment, an author's amendment, that I would like to move, the A1.
Great. Representative Newton moved the A1. Any discussion to the A1? Representative Susinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the bill as it sits, it seems as though that's a pretty big amendment. It's not just a kind of a fix-it. It changes quite a bit the way the money is spent. Am I reading that right, or does research staff, is it more than kind of just a technical amendment, or?
Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that all this does is to cite the specific statutes that would be covered by this amendment.
Representative Susinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the amendment. What's that? Yeah, maybe that'd be. Thank you, Madam Chair. That'd be great.
One second. I think he's looking at.
You'll have to forgive me. This is not the chapter I know so well.
You're doing great.
We could come back to you.
Are there other questions or other discussion while we're waiting for Mr. Gillette?
Yeah, really.
Madam Chair, Mr. Snope is here, and he can help with this.
Mr. Snow, please introduce yourself for the record, and if you have some comments, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Andy Snope. I'm with the IBEW Local 292. We helped the author here craft this bill early on in session. Our desire was to add prevailing wage to RDA funding. It got off to the reviser. The reviser was a little backed up, and since then, we have worked with this language that you see in front of you on the amendment with the Department of Labor and Industry to more accurately reflect some of the statutes that go along with prevailing wage enforcement, wage reporting, wage and hour reporting, and private right of action that comes with the prevailing wage. The original bill just included reference to the wages of prevailing wage. This moves out a little bit further to help the Department of Labor and Industry enforce those wages and benefits that would be required under those statutes.
Mr. Elock, did you?
Just that, Madam Chair, some of the sections that are specifically referenced in the amendment do add some things that weren't in the original bill. For example, Section 177.30 requires employers to keep records of rates of pay, hours worked, things like that. But the rest of those sections are, as Mr. Snope just indicated, allowing the Attorney General to enforce these provisions as well.
Representative Susan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just having the enforcement, and I've got neighbors and friends that have small construction companies, and know, they're just used to going out and fixing a window or putting some insulation and doing these projects. How, I guess I don't understand how this would potentially affect, you know, kind of a small-time carpenter who's working on his own, who happens to win a bid. You know, how much work does that add to a, like, I mean, this seems, it's small, but it potentially could be pretty substantial when it comes to tracking some of this as far as a small local contractor that's just, you know, trying to help his neighbor out with a grant from the RDA. I guess I'm just trying to understand before we pass the amendment, you know, that's all.
And who are you directing a question to?
Maybe the author of the bill or someone that's maybe dealt with this before.
Okay. Now I have a shot at it. That specific reference to statute 177.30 just requires that a record be kept so that you know how much work was done, the amount of time that was spent. That's all that it requires.
Representative Swazinski.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just, you know, but we heard in the last testimony for the last bill that these aren't state funds. They're administered by the state, but they're actually ratepayer funds. So the folks that, you know, are just paying their rates and they have that on top of it for the nuclear cast storage. And I'm trying to jive, you know, we established in the last bill that those are not state dollars. They're just administered. And why is this being brought into, you know, getting in between, like, a homeowner, the grant recipient, and then adding, like, I mean, enforcement by the Attorney General? This seems pretty serious for folks that maybe have just tried to help their neighbor out locally, trying to get the, I mean, this is about, I guess I don't, this seems like a pretty big expansion to me. And I'm just trying to understand that, like, why that would be, why we're, like, private money essentially that the state is administering, not the states, and applying these to that. I'm just trying to get that.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, to me it appears as if it's no more than you would get on a bill which would show what was done and how much you're being charged for what was done. I mean, it's just keeping a record of that, which I think any small business person would do.
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is, you know, obviously the RDA has limited funds, and I think it was a concern of one of the other members on the other side of the aisle was concerned about setting aside potentially $3 million and that money wouldn't be spent other places. Is there any idea how much more this would cost by asking this and how that current process works between, you know, asking for just putting out general bids or requiring a certain amount of pay? Like, how many less projects would potentially move forward if this amendment goes on to this bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Swazinski, the only funding that I see was in the note that we got on the, it'd be the Department of Labor that would, you know, for checking to make sure that whatever requirements we put on are accomplished. You know, it has nothing to do with the RDA funds. They wouldn't be decreased as a result of this. It's the Department of Labor checking to make sure that the project was done.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question wasn't to that part, but it was, you know, well, how about we just, I'll ask questions as we go, maybe. I'm just trying to, before we go on this, I just wanted to make sure that we're on the same page. So thank you.
Seeing no further discussion on the amendment, all those in favor of the A1 say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Newton, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a very simple explanation, but the bill as amended requires that projects fully or partially funded with appropriations from the Renewable Development Fund must pay workers a prevailing wage according to these state statutes.
And so any questions or discussion by the committee? There are some testifiers, I think, who go ahead with the testifiers. Great. Why don't we go ahead, since Mr. Snope is already here. Go ahead and...
Thank you, Chair Akam. Again, Andy Snope with the IBW Local 292. Thank you, Chair Akam and members of the House Climate and Energy Committee for allowing us to testify today in regard to House File 826. This bill would provide additional requirements for prevailing wage and benefits on funds spent from the renewable development account for the purpose of construction projects. I'm the legislative director for IBW Local 292. We represent 5,000 electrical workers in our jurisdiction, as well as today I'm speaking on behalf of the other 14,000 IBW workers throughout the state of Minnesota in the electrical industry. We are here today to speak in support of House File 826. As it says in state statute, it is the public interest in public that public buildings and other public works be constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonability available, and that persons working on public works be compensated according to the real value of their services they perform. It is therefore the policy of the state that wages of laborers, workers, and mechanics on projects financed or in whole by, in part by state funds should be comparable to wages paid for similar work in the community as a whole. This policy has been in place for the state of Minnesota public funds spending on construction projects for quite some time. We believe it is long past due that this same policy is applied to construction type projects funded from the renewable development account. The renewable development fund was originally established through legislation in 1994, a deal worked out between the Prairie Island community, then NSP, and the state of Minnesota in exchange to allow Xcel Energy to store spent fuel and casks in their facility near the Prairie Island community. Legislation, what began as a one-paragraph statute, has since become a full page of a program that has been used to fund renewable energy research and projects, not only in Xcel Energy territory, but throughout the state of Minnesota. In more recent times, this fund has become a legislative discretionary spending source for renewable energy ideas. Almost every renewable energy project and incentive program proposed has a renewable energy account spending mechanism. The RDA fund walks and talks in like the general fund money spending, and for that reason we think that this is long overdue for the fund to carry the same public works wage and hour policy that comes with general fund spending. The 2013 legislative session was the year that the state legislature began a strong focus on renewable energy and carbon reduction. Enacting legislation to promote and incentivize the development of alternative energy moving from legacy energy sources. More solar and wind, less coal and natural gas. Well-paying and great benefited jobs began to disappear as legacy power plants began to shut down. While the IBW's well-trained and diverse construction workforce evolved through this planning phase, and we are able to meet the challenge of changing industries, we also saw a lot of job loss suffered by our brothers and sisters in the legacy power-producing industry. While we watch those jobs in our industries, or we watch those in our industry lose their jobs, more frustration came for workers in the electrical construction industry when, driven by incentives and grants, out-of-state renewable developers flooded the state of Minnesota in search for high profits. This resulted in a race to the bottom of wages and benefits in the renewable energy market. The contractors we work for found it difficult to compete. These out-of-state developers were able to dominate the industry with low-paying wages and benefits that they paid traveling workers from other economic markets around the country. These workers and developers took these investments and left the state of Minnesota's economy to spend the money elsewhere. Just in a few years, we've been able to draw more attention to this issue. We have worked with the PUC and legislators to recognize local hiring, apprenticeship training, and legacy plant job loss that has shifted through our industry, further providing a proven public policy of prevailing wage requirements around renewable energy development account spending is just another piece of the puzzle to promote great careers and strong economy when we promote renewable energy. Please support House File 826 as amended, Please support good jobs, public policy around good jobs, and please help keep local investments and help spur the state's economy. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Next on the list to testify is Kevin Pranis, marketing manager with Liuna, Minnesota, and North Dakota. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Acom. Kevin Pranis on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota. Thank Brother Snope for his testimony, which I think really covered it. I would just underscore, you know, we feel similarly as our energy economy is changing. You know, our strong belief is that jobs and energy should be just as good and just as available to local workers in clean energy and new and emerging technologies as they have been in conventional technologies, which have provided family-supporting jobs for generations. And the energy landscape is changing. It's not all just big thermal plants. You have not only large-scale wind and solar, but you have community solar gardens. You have rooftop projects. You have all sorts of places we're getting energy, and we want to make sure that those jobs are just as good. And we can say in our experience, to the question of sort of public money and energy money, I would agree with Mr. Snope that effectively this has become public money, that it is controlled and dispersed by the legislature. But I also think it's fair to look at if Xcel were using this money to do projects that created energy, either energy savings or energy, Xcel consistently pays wages that are, you know, and their contractors consistently pay family-supporting wages that are consistent with prevailing wage. And so we're really talking about just treating this money the same as if Xcel were spending that money on their system or another utility were spending it on their system, or if it were being spent as a public work. Either way, there's significant benefits here. It's beneficial and practical, and it's unfortunate that in the construction industry, too often we see problems of wage theft and exploitation, particularly targeting immigrant workers, or not only immigrant workers. And so, Mr. Snope spoke to that. We have cases in community solar garden projects of workers who had to go to judges to try to get judgments to get paid, right? Use of temp agency work. We also see cases where what we believe is clear discrimination, where workers are working alongside, immigrant workers work alongside white workers who are making more than twice that rate. That's all of those are things that prevailing wage helps solve. We also know that prevailing wage is practical. I think that Representative Swedzinski asked an important question about what small contractors do when they're required to provide certified payroll. And the answer is, fortunately, we have dozens and dozens of tiny contractors, some with only two or three employees, who regularly work on prevailing wage projects for state agencies, for MnDOT, and there's all kinds of compliance software and other options that are available, union and non-union contractors, who can easily comply. So that's a fair question. Fortunately, all of those tools already exist, so we think this is a reasonable policy. And finally, if we really want to build that construction workforce, not just for energy, but for all of this, we need to be creating those high-quality careers and jobs. And I think the prevailing wage means we're creating careers that pay as well or better than college education, as they should, right? As they should, given the amount of work that our members put in. And we think this is an appropriate policy that will be beneficial to industry and beneficial to communities. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just working through this amendment still because there's so many statutory references. I'm confused by the statutory reference to 177.435 as it relates to agricultural product processing facilities. Why are we adding agricultural product processing facilities into an RDA funding?
I have to defer to Mr. Snope on this.
Welcome back, Mr. Snow.
Thank you, Chair Acom, Representative O'Neill. So 435 is included in the prevailing wage statute, and the Department of Labor and Industry has recommended this language to cover that as well. I know it doesn't seem like it really should cover that, and
right.
Actually I don't really know what an agricultural processing plant is that would be funded by prevailing wage, but in that circumstance, we thought it was important to cover the full prevailing wage statutes that are typically included when speaking about prevailing wage.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, except for the fact that RDA money is for renewable development, and I'm trying to understand what renewable development would have to do with an agricultural product processing facility. And the one before that also is interesting. I don't understand why 177.41, which has to do with building roads, also is in here?
So actually, there is a statute. It's 177.44 that has to do specifically with highway projects.
Yeah.
So 41 is more so a definitions where rates and hours, and within that definition, prevailing wage covers vertical construction as well as horizontal construction, which includes roads. So it really is part of the definition of what prevailing wage covers, but really 44 is the statute that covers highways extensively and road.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at the prevailing wage section, and you've included in section or point 41, you do have 42, you have the definitions. You don't have 43. Let's see, I'm trying to run these through. Yeah, you don't have 43. You do have 43.5. You don't have 44, but you do have 45. So you don't have every section of the prevailing wage portion of statute. You've missed some, but you've added in things. I know we've already adopted this amendment, but I would really ask that as it moves on, that gives in the labor committee that's given a little more scrutiny. It just doesn't make sense when you're talking about RDA money to, you know, a couple of these additional statutory references. Just, I mean, either you include them all or you don't. And you said you included them all, but you didn't. And the ones you did include don't make any sense to me. So if you would just take a look at that, please.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Neill. Actually, this covers everything in 177.41 to 177.435. So 43 is included, 44 is included.
I misread that too.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see that on line 1.5, Representative O'Neill? It's 177.41 to 177.435. So including all in between. Mr. Snow, could you have a...
Yeah, Chair Acom, Representative O'Neill, I suggested the word through there, but someone thought two was better, so maybe that's the confusion.
It is written a little cumbersome. Maybe it could be cleaned up in that sense. But I still question why we're including agricultural facilities and roads and things like that when it's RDA, when clearly... We're not going to be building roads with RDA. I hope we're not building roads with RDA. I'm an Xcel Energy ratepayer, and I think they would be. And I represent the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant and the community surrounding. So we're a little sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would ask maybe the author would take a closer look at that and make sure that it actually pertains to specifically RDA projects.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
Looks like the author is willing to chat with you about that. We do have one person signed up to testify, so maybe we can get that. It's Joe Bosch, I believe. I apologize if I said the name wrong. Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota and North Dakota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Beshe for the record, and I'm with Associated Builders and Contractors in Minnesota. I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity to testify today on House File 826. Our commercial and industrial contractor members and the men and women they employ are part of the 75% of construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals rather than be in a union. ABC is opposed to the expansion of prevailing wage mandates on privately funded construction projects. While the funds in the RDA are administered by the state, these are otherwise private ratepayer dollars that go towards investments in renewable energy projects in Minnesota. Such mandates limit competition and drive up the cost of these projects without any increase or guarantee in quality. Paying a specific wage rate set by the Department of Labor using an outdated survey method has yielded outdated and non-local prevailing wage rates year after year. Nothing in prevailing wage laws ensures local workers are employed on these projects either. Prevailing wage mandates have a negative economic impact in two ways. First, in greater Minnesota, where many of these projects will likely be built and skilled trade pay is typically lower than it is here in the metro, artificially high prevailing wage rates eliminate the local bidding advantage and allow large construction companies from other areas or states to take away local economic development dollars and jobs. Second, higher labor costs drives up the overall cost of construction projects and leads to higher costs for consumers and ratepayers. Our contractor members throughout the state already build wind and solar and other renewable projects for utilities and other private owners without issue. They include excavating, concrete, electrical, and steel erection contractors. You know, there's a lot of talk about safety, you know, but the building trades unions spend countless hours and resources trying to recruit our members, so that should tell you the type of quality and safety records that our members bring to this industry and these projects. We've already seen other bills pass legislature that require prevailing wage agreements on new repowering projects or large wind energy projects, and this is just another example of our contractors being dictated to how they must conduct their business, and leaves our members asking what's next and where does it end. In closing, we would like to urge the committee to vote no on House File 826 and to allow for fair competition when it comes to these projects. Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members again for the opportunity to testify, and I'm available for any questions.
Representative O'Neill, did you have a question? Oh, and I'm sorry. Yes.
I can defer to over there. It's fine.
Oh, go ahead, Representative Holmes. My apologies. I wasn't looking at the list.
Well, I was just going to comment on the bill in general. Is that okay? I didn't have a,
You didn't have a question for the testifier?
No, not for the testifier.
I think it's... Did you have a question to the testifier? Then let's go to there. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, if you could articulate, if you know, the cost difference it would be per project, like if you know, like it's 5% more, 50% more, 100% more, do you have any sense as to the additional cost it might be?
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, it would vary depending on project, but you could be looking at 10% inflation in project costs.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. That's all I had.
Representative Kuczynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, that's interesting, 10%. I was kind of asked that question myself, too. You know, we heard last week in committee talking about when Representative Igo and other members were working on, you know, trying to end slave labor and not use slave labor, you know, when it comes to the sourcing of solar panels. And the author of the bill, I think, replied something along the lines of, you know, we really can't regulate that here at the state. We need to just make sure that no matter what, if we have to weigh the two things, whether we're doing projects or not, we need to err on the side of doing more projects, because the feeling of that, and it seemed like the committee, was that it's more important to do more projects to reduce carbon than it was to protect slaves in other parts of the world. And, you know, if it's increased cost by 10%, that's that much less carbon that will be removed from the atmosphere. And which way do we want it? Do we want projects done to remove carbon or not? You know, if you can do 8 projects with this bill, or do 12 projects without the bill, I don't know what's going to, is it, I mean, technically this amendment will cause more pollution because less projects will happen in our neighborhoods. And I'm concerned whether or not, you know, as the testifier said, that, you know, under current law, you know what, local folks can work with the people they have. Well, if they don't, you know, follow these rules with the private money that the state happens to administer, they're going to lose out. They're going to lose local jobs. I mean, when we say local means a lot of different things, but someone from your hometown, a contractor, that's a concern as a rural person to me. And I get the politics on this stuff, and I understand it. But if we were dealing with real deal state money, we know what the law is. It is what it is. But this is getting right down to the nitty-gritty, folks, of who's going to come in your door. Who's going to be qualified to come in your door to replace a window or an electrical box? It's probably not going to be the person there you used to have in your house. and it's going to cost more. And regardless of the, I mean, the quality is good, I think, on both sides, but boy, this seems like a bit of a stretch for me. And I get, you know, I get the politics of it all, but yeah, that's all I got to say.
I don't think there was a question. I think you can head back. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify just before we bring it back? Make sure that there wasn't anyone else that wanted to provide testimony. Representative Collins.
Thank you, Chair Akam, and thank you, Representative Newton, for bringing this forward. So, to me, this is just a continuation of what my comment previously, when we're talking about RDA funds. I think it's my job to make sure that we are protecting and taking care of all Minnesotans, not just my community and my district. And so when we talk about where the RDA funds come from, the Prairie Island community, that's important to me. But equally as important is on the other end of those RDA funds, the workers and the people who are doing that work that is being funded by the RDA need to be paid fairly. It's a matter of fairness and protecting all people. It's not fair to allow the market to govern, because the people who are being taken advantage of are people from within my community, whether they live in my district and are undocumented immigrants or people from other immigrant communities. We want to talk about slave labor. We can talk about slave labor that is happening right here in Minnesota, because those individuals are taken advantage of. They are treated poorly. They are used without concern for how they are going to be treated, the hours that they're being working, and the safety of their livelihood. And so I absolutely think this is important to make sure that we are caring for our workers so that we can create a good economy for Minnesotans. I feel really passionate about this. I'm really thankful that you're bringing this forward, because I think that this, you know, the money passes through us, and we're calling it state money, but it has an origin where people are at risk. It's our duty to make sure that those people are being heard and that the people at the end of this line are also being heard. And to me, that's the workers who are doing this work that's being funded by the RDA. We are merely being passed through. So I'm really appreciative for you bringing this forward, and I would like to request a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Any other discussion to the bill? Seeing none. I'm so sorry, Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, there was a head in the way. I know it's hard with the shape of the table. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, I went back through the amendment again. I just want to be clear that not everything that's under the prevailing wage portion is in the amendment, and 177.44 is still not in it, which has to do with road construction. So I just, you know, really urge the author to really look at that clearly. And there are some things that probably shouldn't be in there, because RDA doesn't do anything and everything under the sun. It's supposed to be for renewable development, so renewable energy sources. So I just want to clarify that I did look at it one more time, and there was a portion that was left off. It's not the entire section. And then after we vote, I just have one quick follow-up from a previous committee hearing. I just wanted to bring some information back to the committee.
Representative Alton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a really quick comment. But, you know, sometimes we try to label people. If you vote this way, you're this. You vote that way, you're that. I think this bill is not complete. I'm very concerned about the language. I'm concerned about that agriculture. I'm from an agricultural district, and I am concerned that that is in this bill right now. And so just, you know, just be careful that we're not looking at motives and that type of thing. But I will be a no vote.
And I think there's going to be some discussion going forward about potential changes before the next stop. So I appreciate that. Seeing no further, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for, Mr. Beshi? Did I get the name right?
Welcome back.
So she made a comment.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made a comment about the cost differential. What's your source of information for that?
Madam Chair, I will have to get that information to you. It comes from our members and the rates that they currently pay.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I'd be happy to follow up with that information.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd love to see that.
Any other discussion or comment? All right, with that, Any closing comments by Representative Newton?
Madam Chair, I will take Representative Neal's suggestions into consideration and intend to move it through 0.44 by the time it gets to labor. So with that, I would like to renew my motion that House File 826, as amended, be approved and moved on to Labor and Industry Committee.
And the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Representative Swedzinski?
No.
Representative Altendorf?
No.
Representative Bierman?
Aye.
Representative Carroll?
Aye.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative aye?
Aye.
Aye, okay. Representative Garofalo?
Aye.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Igo?
Aye.
Representative Mecklen?
No.
Representative Newton?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill?
Aye.
Representative Ream? Aye. Representative Stevenson?
Aye.
There being 15 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you all.
And with that, oh, I have Representative O'Neill. Thank you.
See, that's why. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's why I reminded you before we gabbled out.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I had asked Mr. O'Grady if he had from Mencia if they had some numbers, and I just want to let you know that I've not gotten any numbers yet, and it's been a little over a week. So I just wanted to report back that I'm still waiting.
Thank you, and I will also follow up, so thank you.
That would be helpful. I think he might answer you, Madam Chair.
We'll see what we can
thank
get.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, this meeting is adjourned.